I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. About a third of people in the U.S. will develop cancer during their lifetimes, according to the American Cancer Society. A cure for the deadly disease has so far been elusive, but billions have been spent in search of it. Today, is it time to change our approach to cancer therapy and research? Instead of trying to treat the deadly cells, one oncologist says we should focus most on prevention. Then, caring for someone with a mental illness takes a toll, both physically and mentally. We'll talk with one caretaker about the hardships that come with the task and get tips on maintaining your own health when attending to someone else. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Here's the thing about cancer. We spend $150 billion a year treating this disease, but the basic methods to eliminate this killer in patients haven't changed in 50 years. One oncologist says we must do better, not just by trying to chase the last cancer cell from the body, but by finding the first cell and preventing cancer from growing to begin with. Dr. Azra Raza is the author of The First Cell and the Human Cost of Pursuing Cancer to the Last. She's the director of the MDS Center at Columbia University, and she joins us this morning from the studios of NPR in New York City. Dr. Raza, what a pleasure to have you. Good morning.
Thank you, Steve, for having me.
Now, you know cancer not only from your work, but from your personal experience with it. Your husband, Harvey, also an oncologist, was diagnosed with lymphoma back in 1998 and took his life 4 years later. You write of that experience, "Cancer is what I had been treating for 2 decades, but until I shared a bed with a cancer patient, I had no idea how unbearably painful a disease it could be." Can you give us a sense of what it was like to face cancer as a doctor and then as a spouse simultaneously?
Yes, Steve, that is a very personal and a question that actually eventually inspired me to write this book called The First Cell. I was also mentored by my late husband, Harvey Preisler, because I came to this country as a young 24-year-old fresh graduate from medical school and immediately started working in his lab and at Roswell Park Cancer Institute and taking care of patients with acute leukemia. And the one rule that Harvey always insisted upon was do not get too close to your patients, because if you get emotionally involved, then you won't be able to make objective and cold decisions about them, and your judgment could become clouded. And I have to admit, I'm not sure if I followed his advice as carefully as he wanted me to. But when he was diagnosed with cancer, the first thing he did, Steve, was turn to me and say, "As you're going to take care of me." And I was so shocked. I said, "Harvey, but you're the one who always told me not to do this." And he said, "Well, I'm sorry. You're the only one whose judgment I trust."
You point out in here that the trio of treatments for cancer hasn't changed in decades, what you call the slash poison burn approach. Doctor, explain that to us.
Let me step back a second before I answer this question, which is, it almost seems like our conversation today was planned or is providential, because just on last Thursday, October 24th, Time magazine carried an essay by the most important, knowledgeable, the most credible and deeply respected scientist in the country, the director of the NIH, Dr. Francis Collins, who lays out his vision of the future of medical science. And within the first paragraph appears this sentence that among the advances that have helped to make the life expectancy of individuals in America go up from 47 years in 1900 to more than 78 years today, are a 70% decline in the U.S. death rate from cardiovascular disease over the past 50 years and a drop of 1% annually in cancer death. So the epilogue of my book, The First Cell, begins with this question. And I recount an anecdote back in 1988 when I was living in Buffalo. My brother, older brother, who's a cardiac surgeon, Dr. Sayed Raza, and I took my mother shopping to a mall in Buffalo. And those were the heydays of coronary artery bypass that had just started. And we could not literally move 50 feet without my brother being stopped by someone, one of his patients he had operated upon or someone's relative he had operated on. They were pumping his hand, congratulating my mother. And this happened for a while. Eventually, on the way back, my mother turned to me and said, you've been living in Buffalo for 10 years. How come I never meet your patients? Why are patients with heart disease doing so much better than cancer patients? And that, I told my mother then that, look, this is a question that my brother and I talk about all the time. It's that cardiologists and cardiac surgeons realize that in order to take care of this horrendous mortality from cardiovascular disease, if they waited for a myocardial infarction to damage the heart muscle, then the only recourse left would be a cardiac transplant. They need to identify the warning signs early and take care of it to prevent this from happening. And so early detection and prevention was begun, and that ended up in this dramatic drop by 70%. And if you look at cancer, as you pointed out, we have not done that as effectively as cardiologists, and we keep chasing after the last cell, trying to kill it with slash poison burn, which means surgery, chemotherapy, radiation therapy. So that it's not that they're not working. 68% of cancers that are diagnosed today are cured just by these methods. Of course, there are some targeted therapies, antibodies, and some innovations that have dramatically helped patients, but that's a minority. What I'm talking about is the majority of the common cancers. If a person is diagnosed with advanced form of any of these common cancers, then the death rate and the morbidity is no better than it was 50 years ago. And the same treatments which are draconian, which have been likened to taking a baseball bat to hit a dog to get rid of its fleas, is how someone has described this slash poison burn treatment for patients. This is still prevalent.
You know, one thing you have trouble with, too, is this use of mice to do cancer research. You have all kinds of problems with that. Tell us why.
I want to make this very clear, Steve. I don't have a problem with using animals in biological experiments. I have no trouble using mice as tools to study biology or genetics. The only problem I have with animal models or any mouse model is in drug development. And the point I always try to make, which gets misconstrued, misrepresented, and then I start getting hate mail from all kinds of researchers, is as if I'm saying we should stop all animal research. No, all I'm saying is we cannot treat an animal with a drug and then expect that we can extrapolate those results to humans. In fact, Norbert Wiener said this in 1940s, that the best model for a cat is another cat, preferably the same one.
So mice are just too different from humans, is what you're saying.
Look, treating cancer as any one disease is like treating Africa as one country. Mm-hmm. Even in the same patient, cancer is not the same in two spots. If a lung cancer metastasizes to the liver, then the properties and characteristics and biological manifestations in that liver tumor are going to be very different than they are in the lung tumor, though the primary origin is the same. So, yes, I'm saying that it is not right to try and treat something in animals and think it will have any consequence or any use in humans. And then amount of resources wasted on this. I don't know why treating a mouse with a new drug and getting a complete response should give me any level of confidence after 50 years of doing the same old, any confidence that this will have the same result in humans. As one of my colleagues says, Azra, there's a lot of healthy mice cured of leukemia running around.
Hey, how are your fellow oncologists reacting to what you're saying? Is it heresy in their world, or is it a breath of fresh air?
Breath of fresh air and more. I can't tell you there's not one negative comment, because everyone thinks exactly the way that I have written this in the book, that we have developed tremendous, beautiful technology to detect the last residual cancer cell left. All I'm saying is, why don't we turn our attention from going after and trying to detect the last cancer cell to using the same technology and improving upon it to identify the first? So instead of minimal residual disease, why don't we go and try to detect minimal initial disease and take care of it quickly?
So why hasn't the profession adjusted and adapted more effectively than what you're describing, given the fact that it's been 50 years and in some ways not a lot has changed?
Do you want my answer in one word?
Please.
Arrogance.
Is that what it is?
I think hubris, arrogance, human overconfidence. We thought that we will be able to just find new oncogenes in the 1980s. It's not like this happened overnight. This has happened over 50 years, and there have been waves of great optimism met with crushing disappointments, which is typical of most fields. But I'll give you an example. In 1980s, we pinned all our hopes on finding a new oncogene. And then we felt like we'll be able to get a magic bullet to target the abnormal protein that is being dictated by this abnormal oncogene. Well, it didn't happen. Then in the 90s, we were very excited first about cutting off blood supply to tumors, and anti-angiogenic therapies were going to cure all and every cancer. Well, it happened in mice very effectively. They were cured of lots of tumors. But when these drugs were brought to the human bedside, 90% of them failed dramatically. A couple have been approved, but they have only palliative short-term improvement in survival. They are not curative at all. So the 90s took care of that. But then the human genome, we pinned all our hopes on the human genome being sequenced. And all of the late 90s and early 2000s, once the human genome was sequenced completely, we were all desperately looking to find the mutations that would allow us to start in individualizing therapy to tailor to needs of each patient because of the mutations they carry. Well, that hasn't happened. It's been now 2 decades since the human genome was sequenced, and we still don't have really any treatment benefit mm-hmm. that is of consequence.
But, Doctor, you're saying that we should focus on the first cell and kill that one before it becomes full-blown cancer. But if we can't effectively kill a lot of cancer cells now, how could we kill that first one?
So I think that's a very good question. The answer is, this is why I'm not saying that all of our efforts should be directed at finding the first cell. I'm saying that more resources should mm-hmm. be given to the first cell rather than, you see, we always have two problems. We have current patients to deal with, and then we have future patients to deal with. Everyone knows that for current patients, if they have advanced disease, we don't have very good answers at all. And if they have treatable disease, then we offer / poison burn. How will we get away from it? Well, if we find the kind of disease I'm talking about at the earliest stage, let me give you one example. For example, when cancer begins, it divides, cancer cells divide faster than normal cells, which means they need more nourishment, which means they start making new blood vessels. The area where lots of blood is going becomes hot. People are right now developing bed sheets that can scan overnight to detect areas that are hot. Women can wear a smart bra just for 1 or 2 hours a week, and the bra is fitted with 200 microsensors that can detect changes in temperature.
Mm-hmm.
So let's say we identify that in somebody's breast, suddenly a hot area has appeared. It doesn't mean we go in and slash it out or try to do anything right now. There's no reason to rely on any one test as the end-all. We can then follow that area, monitor it carefully, see if it's growing, and then start looking by 20 other methods to see whether there are other footprints of cancer, such as some protein being shed in the blood or in liquid biopsies of saliva or tears or urine or sweat or blood. We are finding cell-free DNA being discarded by these cancer cells. And once we find all these various tests are pointing that this is a potentially lethal situation, and what we can do then is now we have this area identified in the breast. We have all these tests proving that this is indeed a dangerous thing for the person. Then we can try to zap it with something like even laser. We can try to zap it with an immune thing, with an immune cell, which can go and target and kill it.
Right.
And if we are, instead of killing hundreds of billions of cells, if we kill a few million, it will not have the same kind of toxicity that / poison burn has today.
Dr. Azra Raza is our guest. She's the author of The First Cell and the Human Cost of Pursuing Cancer to the Last. You know, you also point out that it's time to bring what you call other disciplines, other technologies to the table. Give us some examples of those and what they could offer cancer research, especially when it comes to finding that first cell, which is so much of your focus here.
Yes. I think this has to be what Dr. Ed Wilson has called consilience, a consilience, a cooperation and collaboration across disciplines of all sorts. And one of the projects I've done recently with my younger brother, Abbas Raza, who has a very interesting, wonderful website called Three Quarks Daily, which both of us post stories to every single day for the last 15 years. One of the things I did with this website is carry out a project called the Cancer Questions Project, in which I have asked 30 of the top leadership in cancer in the country the same 5 questions. And one of the questions, for example, is, I was treating cancer, the kind of leukemia I treat, acute myeloid leukemia. In 1977, I was treating this with a combination of 2 drugs, popularly known as 7 and 3. Going forward, from 1977 to 2019, I'm still using 7 and 3 to treat AML. It is a complete embarrassment. How do you see this changing over the next 10 years? Can we do better than 7 and 3? And we are posting this every week on Three Quarks Daily, the answers of my colleagues. And they are really wonderful answers. Mm-hmm. And I have to tell you that most of my colleagues colleagues agree that that we need more interdisciplinary collaboration. We need to bring nanotechnologists. We need to bring computer scientists. We need to bring IT experts, molecular biologists, oncologists, basic scientists, people who are doing scanning and imaging, device development, biomedical engineers. We all have to work together to bring the devices, the biomarkers, the technology needed to go and identify.
No, doctor, I imagine that a lot of this change that you're calling for might accelerate once donors and that donor community begins to recognize the need for change. Are you seeing much impatience in that group and a call for different ways to go after cancer?
You know, this is something that bothers me, Steve, that somehow we are creating an impression in the public that everything is hunky-dory and that we are on target to
cure
cancer.
That's right.
The public is believing that things are very different today than they were 50 years ago. So they are funding generously, and there is no dearth of money in this country. The thing is, it's all being wasted in many things that it shouldn't be wasted in. I'll give you one example that was cited by Dr. Richard Pazdur, who is a wonderfully revered and well-known voice in the country. He's presently heading the Center of Oncology Excellence at the FDA, somebody I deeply admire. And he made a criticism which I couldn't agree more with. He pointed out that there were three well-controlled trials done with an immunotherapy against these checkpoints that have been identified. So the drugs are or agents are called checkpoint inhibitors. So in a bone marrow disease called multiple myeloma, three large controlled trials were done recently and they were negative. So he, Dr. Pazdur, first of all questioned why did three large clinical trials, well-controlled, had to be done instead of one.
Mm-hmm.
And the second thing that was pointed out in Stat News just last month in relation to this was that in addition, at the moment, there are not 100, not 500, not 1,000, 2,200 clinical trials going on right now for agents which are targeting the checkpoints.
Mm-hmm.
2,200. And Dr. Pazdur's sentence was, are patients companies' resources when three large trials have shown? So basically it's this me too mentality where everyone is trying. Once one drug gets approved for a target, everybody and their grandmother want to just go after that target. You know why, Steve? Because presently the failure rate of new drugs brought to a cancer patient's bedside is 95%.
Hmm. Wow.
And the 5% drugs that receive FDA approval, they might as well not have because they're only improving survival by months. So this Me Too mentality is, okay, one drug got approved against a target like a checkpoint, then let's make biosimilars and let's see if we can get it approved as well for perhaps another organ or another indication or some minor distinction, and then we'll make $1 billion. But imagine that they are risking a 95% failure rate, yet they're going ahead. Don't you think this is a waste of resources and waste of donor money?
But your point is that critical thinking when it comes to cancer research is hard to find because so many people think that everything is honky-dory and great progress is being made, when in fact, as you point out, that's not the case.
Yes, exactly what I'm saying, but I don't want to act as if I'm the only one who's got this critical thinking. What I'm pointing out is somehow we have evolved a culture in which individual voices cannot be heard anymore. So, for example, decisions that I have to make for my patients are not my decisions most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
They've been decided by a group of key opinion leaders who very correctly review all the data available in the literature and then come up with the recommendations that if a patient presents with stage 4 pancreatic cancer, then first line of therapy should be a combination of these drugs. When mm-hmm. patient fails, second line should be this, third line should be this. Now, if those key opinion leaders have made that suggestion, and this is now a national guideline for oncologists, if I stray from that, then I am potentially opening myself up to legal challenges.
That's interesting.
A patient can turn around and sue me and say, well, you didn't give me that. That's why I'm dying, because you held this off from me. So I'm saying that somehow, it's not that critical thinking is missing from cancer. It is the system has become so obtunded now that we just can't speak up anymore.
Doctor,
and you know who's paying the price? The patient.
Dr. Azra Raza is the author of The First Cell and the Human Cost of Pursuing Cancer to the Last. She's also director of the MDS Center at Columbia University. Dr. Raza, it's been great to have you. Thanks for sharing your views with us. I sure appreciate it.
Thank you for having me, Steve.
After a break, when we come back, we'll talk with a parent of a daughter who's suffering from mental illness and what kind of struggle they've had in their own household. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. If you're not signed up for our weekly newsletter, you're missing out. Subscribe to Kraske Off Mic at kcur.org/Kraske. Get thoughts on topics and guests from me and highlights from the up-to-date team. Sign up now and get this week's edition delivered this afternoon. Subscribe at kcur.org/Kraske. Tomorrow on the program, how to create smart development in our town. Some say strategic investment in neighborhoods and sensible growth patterns can create lasting value and boost prosperity. We'll ask what that looks like on tomorrow's Up to Date. Well, the first thing to know about caring for a child with a mental health condition is it's not easy. The second thing, you're not alone. The challenges can be overwhelming, not to mention confusing, draining, and sometimes incredibly expensive. Now a conversation about caring for a loved one afflicted with bipolar disorder or schizophrenia. With us, Dr. Carolyn Pepper is a psychologist with UMKC Counseling Services. Dr. Pepper, nice to have you. Welcome.
Hi, thanks.
Lori Mitchell has a daughter diagnosed bipolar schizophrenic. Lori, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Lori, I can't help but wonder, what's the biggest single challenge you faced having a daughter who has struggled with mental illness?
The biggest challenge that I find is having her under control and mm-hmm. to take her meds.
And why is that such a struggle for so many folks who suffer from mental illness?
Well, I believe in my daughter's case that she gets her meds and she thinks she feels good, so then she stops taking them, and then it's a vicious cycle.
Dr. Pepper, this is a pretty common situation, right? Tell us about that.
Yes, absolutely. I pulled some information from the National Alliance on Mental Illness, NAMI, and the numbers they give from 2018 says about 1 in 5 U.S. adults will experience mental illness in a given year. And then when we talk about serious mental illness, that's about 1 in 25 mm-hmm. Folks will experience that in a given year. So incredibly common.
But then the problem becomes doctors like you prescribe medication and patients go on for a while, then they drop off, and that can be when all heck breaks loose.
Sure. So, sorry, psychologists don't prescribe medication, psychiatrists.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yep. But med compliance is a problem for mm-hmm. a lot of mental health conditions, both in terms of feeling better and then discontinuing medication without doctor's approval, but also access and the cost of medication is another
right.
barrier for folks.
Lori, how did the mental illness in your daughter manifest itself? What did you see?
Well, she was diagnosed when she was 19 years old, and as she got older, the episodes got longer and stronger. She just was just unbearable at times. She was never satisfied with the highs and the lows between the manic and the anxiety.
Mm-hmm. That medicine might have gone a long way towards resolving, right?
Yes, if she had been on it consistently and let it manifest in her system.
How was it for you to have to deal with all that? How confusing was it at first?
Oh, gosh. God only knows if I could put it into words.
Yeah.
Very worrisome. I worried about her at all times, and she got to the point where she was so out of control that I couldn't deal with her anymore. I had to literally move from my place of residence to another place where she didn't know. And I also had to just cut ties with her.
What did that feel like?
Helpless. I felt helpless.
Do you hear stories like this very often, Dr. Pepper?
Occasionally, my role is more for caring with folks with mental illness, mm-hmm. but certainly hearing from parents or concerned people in that person's life and that client's life is pretty common.
Lori, when you first got the diagnosis about your daughter, I'm wondering, was it a shock, a blow to the gut? Did it scare you? How did you react to it?
I felt guilt. Like, what did I do to make her like this? You know, like mm-hmm. it was my fault. What did I do? I had to go back in my history and say, well, was I drinking? Did I smoke? Why is she acting like this? And then after I found out.
In the process of raising her, you had screwed up, in other words.
Yes, yes, mm-hmm. exactly. And then as I reflect back, I noticed that her behavior from the other children was always different, you know, more attentive. I had to be more attentive to her, but I thought that was just her being her, spoiled.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then as she got older, 19 is when it really came full force.
There's no guidebook for parents, is there?
No.
When you first hear about this?
No.
Where did you turn for help?
I did a lot of research on Google and just kind of called some hotlines to ask, you know, about the behavior. Is this real?
Yeah.
You know, does it really exist? Is, you know, I did, like I say, a lot of research, and I learned that it was a common factor. Mental illness was a common factor, especially in the Black community. We don't see it as mental illness. We just say, oh, that person is crazy and, you know, mm-hmm. just acting out because of the environment that they're in. But it goes deeper than that. It's actually a medical, physical, I've learned, mm-hmm. you know, horrific, unbearable for anyone to have to deal with and go through.
And I'm just guessing here that as you began to reach out, that wasn't too long before you began to figure out that, hey, you were hardly alone in all this.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And one of the hardest hurdles for me to jump was to do like tough love, you know, mm-hmm. and just to cut her out my life, basically. Although I would still go and seek and look for her or try to get her some help. She's been to every mental facility within the Tri-County area, metropolitan area, from Smithville to Truman, Cottonwood Springs, somewhere out in Olathe.
How did those work for you?
They didn't. As soon as she was able to get, they were able to get her stabilized, which was 78 hours. They do a little Q&A with her. She answers the questions the way that she was trained. She, like, trained herself. She knew exactly what to say to them, how to manipulate them. She'll sign herself out and back out on the street she goes, or back home to me to drive me nuts some more.
You know, Carolyn, as you listened to all this, you know, pretty tough to hear. The system Absolutely. Wasn't able to help somebody like Laura. Mm-hmm. Lori, what needs to happen here?
Oh, gosh. It's such a system-level problem, right? Mm-hmm. Hospitals are not set up to treat folks with this kind of severe mental illness. They're
Even
solely
psychiatric hospitals.
Yeah, it's about stabilization.
The insurance companies say you can only keep that patient so long because he or she is saying, responding to the
right.
questions, okay, send her out the
Just
door.
Just like Lori was saying, you kind of know what to say, and then, you know, mm-hmm. but, you know, you're back out kind of on the street. And there's so many layers and intersectionality of the mental illness itself, but then things like homelessness, substance use and addiction, the difference in access to resources for folks of marginalized identities, all of this stuff layers and complicates what the mental illness presents as and makes treatment that much harder.
So what should we be thinking about here as a society? Because we're hearing more and more talk about mental illness, how common it is. Mm-hmm. Senator Blunt in Missouri talks mm-hmm. about this issue a lot. But what should be the path forward? What do people need to think about here?
Yeah, so apart from the system level change, on a smaller level, it's really about stigma and fighting stigma.
That's changing too, though, isn't it?
Yeah, I think there's some indications, but not enough. And it's still incredibly prevalent, especially in different communities, right? Mm-hmm. Like we were talking
yes.
about in African-American communities, it's stigma around mental illness or mental health issues looks maybe different than in a white population. It mm-hmm. just, it looks different. Mm-hmm. There's an idea called courtesy stigma, which is the stigma that a caregiver can be sort of subject to based on the mental illness, the stigma of the mental illness of that family member. So the stigma even spreads not just to the individual with the mental health concern, but those caregivers too. And then that limits the availability for that person to get resources and to get help. And
it's really tough stuff.
Yes.
Very complicated issue.
Yes.
Yeah. What would you tell a parent who's just starting off on a journey like this, Lori, to help them begin to wrap their arms around this?
Well, from my experience, I would say to get as much knowledge as you possibly can and to reach out to the help hotlines and learn to get different avenues that of people who advocate for mental health illness. Mm-hmm. It's really hard and it's really difficult to deal with it, endure it by yourself. Mm-hmm. You know, you really need a strong support group. Fortunately, I have family members that support me and worry about me as well as my daughter. And it's really heartbreaking. And I'm just thankful that I have God in my life to help me to stay afloat.
Mm-hmm. At what point, how old was your daughter when these symptoms began to manifest themselves?
Well, if not, like I said, when I reflect back in the past, I could see it now, hindsight 2020 from when she was a child.
Mm-hmm.
But it really manifests when she was 19 years old. And I found out that that's the time when that syndrome starts, you know, between the ages of 19 and 25 or 28, 17 to 28, somewhere in those numbers.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, I felt guilty. I thought it was something that I lacked as parenting.
Yeah. And maybe a message is, that's not the case.
That's not the case.
Yeah. If you're just joining us this morning, you're listening to Up to Date. We're talking about sharing a household with a child who might be suffering from mental illness, bipolar disorder, schizophrenia. If you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888 is our number, or you can tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. Dr. Carolyn Pepper, what is it about the ages of, as Lori just said, 18 to 27, whatever, what's going on in the human body that would trigger a mental illness like bipolar or schizophrenia during those years?
Sure. There's a few things going on. One is that certain mental health disorders or mental illness, that's when they emerge, is in early adulthood, those late teens.
Do we know
early
why then?
It's complicated, right? There's some biological reasons for that. A lot of folks at that time, too, are experiencing a developmental transition. Maybe they're leaving home for the first time. At sort of minimum, you're individuating, moving away from your family of origin, kind of striking out mm-hmm. on your own.
Right.
So resources change, your support groups change. There's stressors that kind of occur developmentally at that time that can exacerbate those
yeah.
sorts of things.
Yeah, I'm just wondering about, Lori, when things would get tough around the house, did you feel you could call the police and get some help there?
Oh, I have done that. My daughter is well known in with the police department throughout Kansas City, Gladstone, and Liberty.
Okay.
They know her by name. They weren't equipped to handle her. The best thing that they could do was take her away from the premises, because she would be in such rage, and I would have to take up time and explain to them she has mental illness. I can't, you know, she didn't do anything per se physically to me, but she's so disruptive, nobody can deal with her. And at that point, it was like I was pushing her buttons, so mm-hmm. then she would get into an outrage while they were there. The police officers were there, and then they would take her out, and they would take her to St. Luke's, or they'll take her to Truman, or they'll take her to North Kansas City. And then we had to go and fill out all these affidavits. My other daughters and I would fill out affidavits, you know, saying that she has mental illness. So for them to even acknowledge the fact that she is clinically or mentally ill, and for them to treat her.
Mm-hmm.
And after 72 hours, sometimes 42, she'll sign her right back out once they calm her down. She could sign herself right back out and come and harass. She would start harassing the family.
Mm-hmm. What did she say about why she didn't stay on her meds?
She's told me personally that once she was on the meds and she started feeling better, she felt as though she didn't need them. You know, and I try to explain to her, just like I take high blood pressure medicine or I take heart medicine or somebody takes diabetes. If you have an illness, you have an illness and you have to do preventive maintenance in order to prevent the episodes. But for some reason, that did not connect in her brain. I don't need this medicine is what she would say.
Carolyn, is there something you've come across during your years of practice, some words of wisdom that you could offer a young person to convince them to stay on their meds? Is there a magic set of words here? Because lots of parents out there have searched for those words.
Yeah, I think if they were magic words, right, what part of this conversation wouldn't have to be
right,
had.
Right.
I think your analogy to comparing it to a chronic physical illness like diabetes or something like that is a great analogy. But a lot of times the person's pathology itself gets in the way of recognizing that they need to continue with medication, stigma around that. There's lots of things that...
Sometimes you also hear it sort of bottles up my creativity when I take the meds. It doesn't allow me to... I feel bogged down when I take the meds.
Yeah, side effects are a real problem. And weight gain, loss, disruptions in sleep, feeling, cloudy cognitively.
Yeah.
Those are common side effects.
Gloria from Excelsior Springs. Gloria, good morning.
Good morning. Pardon me. I want to tell you that with good doctors and family that cares, I feel I'm one of the lucky ones. I was diagnosed at age 24, and I'm a senior citizen, and I saw in AARP magazine of April 2019 an individual who at age 64 finally figured out what was wrong, and he'd had a life of broken marriages, lost jobs, and he was finally connecting with children that had always been estranged from him. And
Gloria, what were you diagnosed with?
Bipolar.
Bipolar, okay. But they figured out early what it was, it sounds like.
Yes. I had a psychologist and a psychiatrist at a hospital in another state, and they gave me the MMPI, I think that's what it's called, and they somehow, just based on my classic symptoms, had a pretty good idea from the things I was saying what was wrong with me. So I felt that both the police department in Lincoln, Nebraska, and Lincoln General Hospital were sensational at getting me the help that I needed. And it scared me so much that I have been a compliant patient all my life. I don't want to repeat what went on.
She was one of the lucky ones, it sounds like, Carolyn.
Yeah, it's great to hear kind of when those systems work. Early intervention, you know, being key.
It can work. Gloria, I really appreciate you sharing your story with us. Stephanie from Kansas City, Missouri, good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, go ahead, Stephanie.
I was telling your producer that my son was diagnosed with schizophrenia and bipolar when he was about 16. On top of that, he came out as transgender at 15. And so we had both of those issues to deal with. He refused to take his medication, and with your guest today because we were in every treatment just like her, and my son knew exactly the right words to manipulate and get out of there. And I would just get so frustrated and say, you're professionals, you can't see that he's manipulating you,
right?
But they would just stick a Band-Aid on it and let him go. And finally I had to do what your guest did, and I just had to disassociate myself. When the summer after his senior year, he ended up pulling a knife on me, and he was on house arrest. And fortunately, he had to stay with his dad for that summer, and I had to completely disassociate myself from him. And it's the only way that I stayed sane. And now he's doing great. He's on his medicine.
Wow.
We have a great relationship, and he is doing fantastic. But
you should know, Stephanie, while you were talking, Lori, our guest here in the studio, was giving you a thumbs up. She's experienced exactly what you've been through, it sounds like.
Terrible.
Yeah.
So, I'm sorry. You just feel so helpless as a parent. But, you know, he calls me now all the time, and we text, and he's a junior at KU, doing great. We have the relationship. If you had told me this 3 years ago, I would have said you were completely insane, and it's been a complete turnaround. So hang in there. Don't give up.
There's hope.
It can get better.
Yeah, Stephanie, thank you for the call. And Carolyn, you were nodding your head as Stephanie was describing her son's sexual transformation. Is that linked in some way, or am I, is that a yeah. factor in all this?
Yeah, factor, yes, not linked. There's lots of things that make folks more at risk for mental health concerns, mental illness, being marginalized, right? Systems of oppression, marginalization, whether that's race or ethnicity, income, education level, LGBTQIA folks are more also at risk for developing mental illness, but it's because of those systems of oppression, not that identity itself.
Right. We're talking about living with someone with mental illness this morning. Our number, 816-235-2888. Eric from Overland Park, you're on Up to Date, Eric.
Hey, yeah, I don't typically call. This really resonated. About a year ago, and I'm putting this in quotes, adopted a 23-year-old trans kid because he got kicked to the curb by his family. And I'm a big guy. But he assaulted me like 3 or 4 different times. And just that, you know, the same pattern, I think, that the lady before had talked about with her trans son. And I got to tell you, I ended up kicking him out like 3 or 4 different times, called the police, called therapists. I'm in Overland Park. So Johnson County, nobody ever, ever came to, there was no follow-up, nothing. The kid's working as a prostitute now. So, yeah, I mean, I had never been exposed to this. I don't have kids, but I got to tell you, it was a year from hell, if I can say that on the radio.
Yeah, no, you can. Eric, I really appreciate your phone call here, Eric. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thank
you. Good luck.
You.
Yeah. Dr. Peppers, are some mental illnesses harder to care for than other types of mental illnesses?
Sure, absolutely.
Such as?
Certain mental illnesses can be more chronic in nature. Bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, like we've been talking about, mm-hmm. are some. But even certain types of depression can be more chronic and lifelong and not single episode. So it really runs the gamut.
What's the best thing you can do for someone who's suffering from mental illness?
In terms of a caregiver?
Sure.
Yeah, get support for yourself, right? So whether that's sort of psychoeducation about the illness, get familiar with support groups that are in your community, maybe consider therapy, right, for yourself as a place to talk about and explore your own feelings, that if you are going to sort of engage in caregiving for someone with a serious mental illness in particular, you've got to take care of you first so that you can take care of someone else.
Lori, does that resonate with you?
It really resonates with me because I was in, like I said, I was in denial in the beginning that my daughter was just had this illness, you know, I was feeling guilty. But as the year surpassed, she became so violent and just upset the whole household. The whole entire family was dysfunctional. And that's when I had to cut ties with her and regroup and realize I can't help her if I can't help myself.
There's a group called NAMI. What is NAMI, Carolyn? Real quickly before we go.
National Alliance on Mental Illness. And it's a great resource.
They have meetings in town, support groups for parents.
Affiliates and great information.
Just Google NAMI. That's a good place to start to get some
great
help.
Place. Yes,
I want to thank Dr. Carolyn Pepper, a psychologist with UMKC Counseling Services. Lori Mitchell, whose own daughter was diagnosed with bipolar schizophrenia. And Lori, thanks for sharing your story. Really appreciate it.
I hope it can help someone out there.
You bet.
It will.
Tomorrow on the show, a local Kansas City group is presenting a tenant bill of rights to the city council on Thursday. We'll find out what rights they're proposing. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Elizabeth Ruiz, and Jamie Hobbs. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.